times throughout his short life, and had always believed them, but suddenly, for the first time, he felt they might not always be true. Perhaps he didn't understand now, but what if he might at some future point? He'd understood sadness, hadn't he? It made Meg laugh. What if understanding living people was something that could be learned, like anatomy or the alphabet? Maybe I could, he said carefully. He didn't want to commit himself to anything too drastic. Yeah, snorted Jackson, maybe you could. Patrick's spirits lifted even further. Jackson agreed with him. Maybe he could learn. And if something could be learned, then Patrick knew he could learn it. All it took was motivation. Chapter 21. Patrick didn't go in the day they did the eyes, but when he came back for the next session, it was to find that the top had been sawn off every cadaver's skull. 30 brains were exposed like giant walnuts, and the smell of fresh bone dust hung in the air. The circular saw was sitting where Mick had left it on the counter by the door, like a horror film prop, with skin and frayed flesh still clinging to its ragged teeth. The final stage of dissection was underway, and Patrick felt giddy with anticipation. He was suddenly acutely aware of his own head, and imagined all the things going on inside it, all the electricity and connections and creativity, something from nothing bursting out of the darkness and lighting the way to the universe. How did all that just end? Where did it all go? And once it was switched off, could it ever be switched back on? So far, number 19 had been thoroughly dead. But if any spark remained, or any promise of more than a mere spark, then it would be found in this most tantalizing of organs. Over the course of a morning, they prized the brain out with spoons, and it flopped into Patrick's hands like a water-filled balloon. He shook a little as he turned it, his eyes and his fingers probing the jelly-mold mind for clues, while the others peered over his shoulders and prodded at it with their blue fingers. Patrick felt his excitement morph seamlessly into disappointment. Not the disappointment of a child denied a treat, but the kind of disappointment that makes the chest ache and the belly roll with nausea at the loss of all hope. There was nothing. The tightly packed convolutions were wrapped in dura, decorated with a network of nerves and fed by thick arterial passages like mine workings in Blancmange. The pink-grey folds taunted Patrick with their perfect mystery. Whatever had made number 19 the person he had once been was now lying right here in his hands. And yet there was no trace of him left, nor any clue as to how he had disappeared. No pearl, no tumour, no secret passageway to the beyond. Patrick felt hope desert him. Death was an inverse Big Bang, an impossible magic trick, where everything had become nothing in the very same instant, where one state had been replaced so completely by another that no evidence of the first could be detected, and where the catalyst had been vaporized by the sheer shock of the new. Patrick felt his face grow hot, and he stared stupidly down at the perfect practical joke overflowing in his palms. If there were no answers here, then he no longer knew where to look for them. He fumbled the brain to Dilip and walked out of the dissecting room in a blur. Patrick was in the cafeteria, not eating chocolate pudding, crisps, and a tuna sandwich, in that order. Outside the window he always faced was the rack where he always locked his bike. He could get on it and ride away. There was nothing here for him now. Now that he knew a dead man was no better than a dead bird, a dead father. If he had kept hold of his hand, would that have anchored him to life? Would the car have missed him, or hit them both, and revealed the truth to two instead of one? "Can I sit here?" said Meg, and then sat there anyway, before he could do anything about it. "Penny for your thoughts," she said.
"What?"
"Penny for your thoughts." Patrick stared at her blankly, and she went a little pink. "My grandma used to see it. I'll give you a penny and you give me your thoughts." Patrick didn't like the sound of this game.
"Do I have to?"
"No, of course not."
"You haven't even given me a penny."
It's just a silly saying, you don't take it literally.
But Patrick was still perturbed by the whole concept. And a penny is nothing. You can't get anything for a penny. You'd have to pay a lot more than that. Meg sighed.
You don't have to tell me anything.
I know I don't.
I just wondered if you were okay, that's all.
No, I'm not, said Patrick.
What's wrong?
Patrick stirred his chocolate pudding mechanically, the spoon grating on the china.
There's nothing there, he said. It's just meat.
Meat and shit.
Oh, she said carefully. What did you expect?
Something else. Something more. He felt weirdly like crying, and his stomach knotted and ached the way it had that day. The day of the punch in the back, the bat in the face. He knew now what sad looked like. Was this how it felt? He didn't like it.
But there is more, she said, grabbing the salt cellar for emphasis. Just because we don't know doesn't make it any less amazing. Can't you feel it?
No, I can't, he said. If someone dies and you don't see it, how do you know what really happened?
See what?
The thing that changes between here and there, between life and death. I can't feel it. I want to see it. I want to know what it is.
We'll all know that one day.
I want to know it now, he snapped. There was a long silence while Meg stared into the crusted hole where the salt lived. She cleared her throat.
You're different, you know.
Only different from you, he said. Not different from me. That's true. She smiled. Then she poured a careful little pyramid of salt onto the table.
What's it like to be you? She said.
Patrick was surprised. Nobody had ever asked him what it was like to be him, not even his mother. What was it like? He'd never even examined it himself before. Never been asked to come to a conclusion about it and share it with another. But Meg hadn't called him names, and she wasn't rushing him. And so, for the first time in his life, he reached into himself, in the hope of finding something to tell her, something to show her, in the same way that number 19 had submitted to being opened and deconstructed. It's... He scraped slow chocolate patterns in the bottom of the bowl. While he struggled to corral his feelings and put them into words, Meg waited for him.
It's very...
He gritted his teeth. This was crazy. There was so much in there. He could feel a million things coursing through him, and yet he kept coming up empty. It was like putting his hand into a tank filled with goldfish and trying to grab one. He'd done that in a pet shop once, and it hadn't worked. And his mother had slapped his legs. Still Meg waited. And suddenly Patrick was filled with a tight, burning frustration at his inability to explain what it was like.
It's very, he said forcefully, very, very.
Very what? She asked quietly. But he had nothing to give her, even when he tried. He dug his spoon so hard into the bowl that it rang and spewed chocolate across the table.
Very, said Patrick.
People looked at them in a sudden hush. Then the faces turned away, and the low drone of voices and echoes and cutlery resumed. Meg simply nodded.
It must be.
Chapter 22.
They're trying to kill me. I don't think it's my imagination, although that's what the doctor's telling the woman who says she's my wife. My woef is how I think of her now. Not the same thing.
Paranoia is common. Emerging coma,
he whispers, trying to keep me from hearing, but I get the gist.
A normal response. Situation.
They both glance at me with the same expression, concern and pity, and the need to keep things from me for my own good. Maybe I wouldn't be paranoid if they weren't out to get me. The idiot Tracy Evans, who regularly unplugs my heart monitor so she can plug in the electric razor. The cleaner who bumps my bed with a mop and glares if I wake, and the doctors who stand over me, too close, too watchful, and make covetous notes that they hang on my bed for everyone to see but me. Every time one of them stands over me, the sweat runs into my eyes and stings a warning. Even my woef, She's supposed to be on my side. She doesn't seem to notice that I'm an old man now. She says she loves me, calls me darling.
Someone killed the man in that bed.
She'd looked at the possum screen, then looked at the bed, frowning, as if the fact that the man was no longer there somehow cast doubt on my claim.
Secret,
I'd begged her with my eyelids.
Secret.
Doesn't she understand English? Now the doctor looks at me but whispers to her.
Infection. Several days. Sometimes sudden cardiac episode. Vulnerable.
There it is again.
Vulnerable.
The thing that makes me feel most vulnerable is you bastards whispering in a corner about me. That doctor might even be the one. He might be the killer. Now he knows I saw something. Now he knows. And what will he do about it?
Anything he likes.
Fuck you, doctors. Fuck you, nurses. Fuck you, Woof. That's the last time I trust you. The last time I confide.
She comes back over and starts to repeat the lies. Sam, sweetheart, the doctor says, deep and squeaky. Darling, I'm trying to,
I want my wife back. I want my child. I want to speak and eat and move my own feet. I want to know what happened to the man in the next bed. And I want to know what happened to me. If I have to do it all myself, I will. I can't rely on anyone else.
I see that now.
I put everything I can into it to let her know how angry I am.
Sam, please.
She takes my hand and I close my eyes. I know that hurts her. She starts to cry and I don't care.
Chapter 23.
The more Patrick scrubbed his bedroom carpet, the more he felt betrayed by the corpse. Number 19 was not a rabbit or a crow. Number 19 had been a man, just like his father, and Patrick felt the cadaver had somehow reneged on a species-specific agreement to give him the answers he sought. Instead of revealing what happened when a person stopped working, Number 19 had only added to the confusion with his elusive cause of death. And Meg had only rubbed his nose in it, going on about how ignorant they all were. As if Patrick didn't know that. He was sick of being confused about everything. Losing his father had at first seemed to be a kind of confusion, like losing a glove or a sock. Those things didn't cease to exist just because you couldn't see them. They were always somewhere, under the bed, in the machine, down the back of the sofa, and eventually they turned up. Sooner than eventually, if you actively looked for them. So Patrick had actively looked. Ever since the school counselor had told him about the one-way door, Patrick had tried to find some sign of where it was and how it might be opened. First, he'd sorted in the animals and birds he brought home off the beacons. Then in the faces of the dead that he found on macabre postcard collections. Or of the dying in African aid stations on the news at 10. Finally, he searched the eyes of racehorses as they waited patiently for the bullet on snapped legs, in the only sport where death was routinely televised. With every crashing fall, Patrick felt the shock of the inevitable, and then a tingling in his belly, a bubble of anticipation in case this was the one, this was the horse, this was the moment when all would be revealed to him, when the door might open just a chink and allow him to glimpse a deathly Narnia on the other side. He had never come close. Up in arms, Malaga, Freeze Out, Luckbox, each now knew the secret he was so desperate to share. But watching them die only left him feeling more empty than before. Still, Patrick wrote their names in quiet pencil lists, because who else would mark their passing? His father had remembered Persian punch with a pint and a bottle of Coke. It seemed only right to do something. The carpet was filthy. He'd already emptied his bucket of dirty water twice, and only properly cleaned a patch a foot square. Under the dark brown, it was a vile ginger. Patrick didn't like it, but he was determined to reveal it anyway. He emptied more blackened water into the bath, refilled the bucket, and added another dollop of bleach.
"What are you doing?" said Jackson.
"You wouldn't understand," said Patrick.
"Huh?"
he said, and Patrick showed him the scrubbing brush.
"I'm cleaning." Oh, very funny, said Jackson, then followed Patrick back to his bedroom, and hung around in the doorway as if cleaning were a spectator sport.
Have you seen Pete lately?
What's lately?
In the last couple of weeks.
No. Patrick realized he wasn't going to be able to do this all in one go, so he mentally divided the visible carpet into squares.
I think maybe they broke up,
Jackson went on. Patrick didn't feel that required an answer. Not that he had an answer, or an opinion, although he did hope Kim had washed the kimono.
Do you think I have a chance? Said Jackson.
Patrick sat back on his heels and thought about it. He wasn't quite sure what Jackson was talking about, but horse racing had taught him that everything had a chance, of death and of glory. The idea invigorated him, and suddenly he felt his determination surface again from the mud of betrayal. He was employed in solving a far bigger mystery than number 19's cause of death, so he shouldn't let something as simple as that get the better of him. Patrick knew exactly where to get the information he was entitled to.
Yes, he said, I do.
Jackson said, thanks. Then, in a rare burst of generosity, he added,
Your carpet looks great.
Not yet, thought Patrick, but it would. He got to his feet and dropped the brush into the bucket with a plop. He was newly filled with hope, and his head and nose felt suddenly clear again. He wondered briefly whether it was the bleach. He lifted his bicycle off the wall and started down the stairs. He wasn't going to be beaten by a carpet or a corpse. 4017. Patrick prickled at the need for the offensively random code. The door of the anatomy wing clicked shut behind him, damming the flow of other students and leaving him alone in the quiet corridor creak that led to the dissection room, and beyond that the stairs leading down to the embalming room, where Mick spent most of his time. His pumas made a low squeak on the scuffed tiled floor. The white double doors of the DR were not locked. It wasn't a dissection day, and so the cadavers lay patiently on their tables, looking lost without their attending students. Patrick picked out number 19's domed form from across the room. He felt a sense of adversity that had not been there before.
You can't keep secrets from me.
Mick was not in his office, and a note on the half-glazed door told Patrick that he would be back at 3:30 p.m. Patrick looked at his watch. It was only 11 a.m., but he was on a roll and had no interest in coming back at 3:30. 3:30 was light-years away. He tried the door handle and it opened, so he went inside. Mick ran a tight ship. There were uncluttered shelves, a well-swept floor, a single pot plant on a filing cabinet. The desk was clear, but for a tidy with two pens in it and a three-tier letter tray that held only a few donation and cremation forms. Patrick approved of the tidiness, even if it meant the clipboard which held the cause of death checklist was not just lying around. There were two pale grey filing cabinets beside the desk. Patrick tried the drawers of both, but they were locked. He rattled them, but this time it didn't work. His determination became frustration in a heartbeat. The cadaver was still trying to cheat him, still guarding its mysteries, even though it was dead and had no use for them itself. But Patrick had waited so long and worked so hard. He deserved to know the answers. It wouldn't be wrong. He was entitled. He had seen TV shows and films where people did things like sneaking into villains' headquarters to uncover top-secret information, so he knew it was possible. But the movers made it look like a major operation that was unlikely to be achieved without satellite communications and a grappling hook. A black turtleneck sweater at the very least. He had none of those. He looked around the bare little office, then went back out to the dissecting room and selected a robust carving fork from the white tray near the door. He inserted the tines into the metal drawer to lever it open. As he did, he noticed that the plant on top of the cabinet was tilted at a slight angle. He couldn't leave it like that. He knew that the moment he saw it. He couldn't even concentrate on the task at hand until it was righted. He put down the fork. Under the pot was a saucer, and under the saucer was the key to the filing cabinet. Inside the top drawer, the first cabinet he opened was the clipboard.
Easy.
On the board was the form he'd only glimpsed before, as Mick walked among them, wishing them ill. Patrick's eyes were drawn directly to the last column labelled COD, Cause of Death. Number 19 had died of heart failure. That couldn't be right. Patrick had held that heart in his hands. There'd been no stenosis, no clots, no aneurysm. He had come in here to uncover a secret, only to find that the secret was a lie. He glared at the form, feeling cheated, wanting more, and noticed that the very first column was headed Name. He ran his eyes down the list.
What are you doing here?
He turned. Mick was in the doorway. Patrick looked at his watch.
What are you doing here? The note said you'd be back at 3:30.
Mick opened his mouth and raised his eyebrows so high that they almost touched the place where his hair would have been, if it had any. He closed the couple of paces between them and snatched the clipboard from Patrick's hand.
That's confidential information.
I wanted the cause of death. That's not confidential. Dr. Spicer said we could ask any time. And this is any time, and you weren't here to ask, so I looked.
You broke into a locked filing cabinet.
I used the key.
The hidden key.
If it was hidden, I wouldn't have found it because I wasn't looking.
Mick brushed past him and put the clipboard back in the drawer, then slammed the drawer and locked it. He dropped the key into his pocket.
What's your name?
Why did everyone always want to know what his name was?
Patrick Fort.
You're in a lot of trouble, said Mick.
What for?
I just told you what for.
Why?
Patrick was confused. He had explained everything.
Don't play stupid games with me. I'm going to speak to Professor Maddock about this.
Okay, said Patrick.
Mick seemed disappointed that he wasn't more worried by the prospect.
All right, you can get out now.
Okay, said Patrick, but didn't go.
I think the cause of death is wrong.
What cause of death?
Number 19. You've got heart failure, but the heart is not diseased.
If that's what's on the death certificate, that's what it is. I'm not a doctor, and neither are you, by a very long way.
I know that, but...
No buts. This conversation is over.
Okay, said Patrick, so started a different conversation. When the people die, you embalm the bodies, right?
Mick looked at him, but didn't answer. So Patrick went on.
Where do they go afterwards?
They come up here, said Mick. Then when you lot have finished with them, I put all the bits in a bag, and they go back to the families for funerals.
Not the bodies, the people.
Excuse me.
Is there an exit?
A what?
An exit. In their heads, like a door they go through.
Like the one I should have kept locked?
Yes, said Patrick. Like that. Some kind of barrier that people go through when they die.
Mick squinted at Patrick. He shook his head. He made a face.
No,
he finally said.
Then what happens to them? Where do they go? Can they come back?
Mick stood and stared at Patrick for a long moment, then reached down and lifted up the phone.
Hold on a second, he said. I'll see if the police know.
Okay, said Patrick,
and waited to see if the police knew. Mick stabbed the first two nines with a flourish and a glare, but then sighed and hung up.
Just get out, will you?
Okay, said Patrick.
In his excitement, he'd forgotten his gloves, and by the time he'd cycled back to the house, his fingers were red and numb. He ran hot water into the kitchen sink and held them under, then stared out of the window that faced next door's fence, and let his mind drift like kelp on a turning tide. The window was dirty. He would have to wash it. He was hungry, and he was out of bread. Once his hands had warmed up, he would put on his gloves and go over the road and get chips. His mouth tingled in anticipation of vinegar, and he thought of all the twists and turns the chips would have to take as they dropped into his stomach, all the places they'd have to avoid, all the choices his body would make for them, all the chemistry it would employ to break them down, how his peristaltic muscles would guide them along the conveyor belt of his guts, until he passed them sometime tomorrow morning. Patrick took his hands from the water and dried them on the tea towel, while his brain turned its inevitable wheel to what had killed number 19. The list on the clipboard was almost as disappointing as the brain had been. He had gleaned only one piece of additional information, and that felt like a very minor victory in a failed war of secrets. The corpse's name was Samuel Galen. Chapter 24.
Not bad, Sam, Leslie tells me, filled with gloom.
but it's praise indeed from him, and I redouble my efforts to retrain my tongue, stretching, sucking, blowing, and braying.
"Have you eating and drinking soon?"
he adds grudgingly. This turns out to be a big fat lie, but I do make progress. The tongue is a magnificent thing. I think about it a lot now that all my hopes and dreams depend on it, and less than a week after my woof betrayed me to a possible killer, Jean and Tracy prop me up in bed and spoon orange juice down my throat. Elixir of the gods. I know everything is relative, but it tastes so good to me that I actually start to cry.
"Ah, look how happy," says Jean.
"Ah," parrots Tracy Evans, but I can see she's not interested. She barely looks at me, and keeps clattering the teaspoon against my teeth. She's looking for the man she's trying to, well, seduce is too elegant a word. She thinks we don't see. I suppose she thinks we're all vegetables. But I see, I know what she's up to. I knew girls like her at Hot Stuff in Merthyr. All the lads knew them, sometimes twice a night. She puts the juice in too fast, and I feel the strange and horrible sensation of it going down the wrong way.
"Ah!"
Jean notices, bless her. She jumps up and rushes to get a machine I've seen them use on other patients. It's like a vacuum cleaner, and she feeds it down my throat and sucks stuff out of my airway with a nasty, rattling sound, while Tracy stands there with her arms crossed, as if I'm making a fuss about nothing and had better not blame her. But in Jean's eyes, I can see how serious this could be. She puts the horrible tube into me twice more and collects watery orange mucus in a kidney bowl while my eyes stream with something similar, and I fight to keep breathing. Finally, she stops and takes Tracy away, for a bollocking, I hope. I lie there panting, feel as if I've been punched on the inside, all my fresh hopes scrunched into a stupid ball and tossed away. Even if they're not trying to kill me, they might yet succeed. And all I can do is lie here and wait for it.
"Patrick Fort," said Professor Maddock, as if he were a long-lost friend. "Have a seat."
Patrick sat down and looked around. Professor Maddock fiddled with a Rubik's Cube behind the vast wooden desk that held two silver-framed photographs, one of a smiling young woman and the other of a boat. There was another photo of the same boat on the wall behind him, with the professor himself looking tanned and rich, waving from the puffy red depths of a life jacket. Patrick could read the name painted on the prow, Sharp End.
"Damn thing," said Professor Maddock of the Cube. "You ever done one of these?"
"Yes," said Patrick. The professor put it down and cleared his throat.
"I hear you've had a few run-ins, Patrick. A few problems."
"No," said Patrick. "No problems."
"That's not what people have told me."
"Okay." Professor Maddock looked at a piece of paper in front of him.
"Inappropriate attitude to staff, a near physical altercation with a fellow student over a cadaver, ignoring procedure during dissection, and unauthorized access to confidential donation details."
"I wanted to know the cause of death. That's not confidential."
"That's not the point," said Professor Maddock.
His hand strayed towards the cube, but he caught it in time and drummed his fingers on the desktop instead.
"You broke into a locked filing cabinet."
"I used the key."
"It was locked for a good reason."
"What reason?"
"For reasons of confidentiality."
"But the cause of death isn't confidential." How many times did he have to say it?
"But the identity of the donor is."
"But I don't care about the identity of the donor. I only wanted to know the cause of death."
"Listen," said Professor Maddock more sharply. "This is a medical school, not a kindergarten. We won't tolerate this kind of disruption from our students, even ones with issues."
"What issues?" said Patrick.
Professor Maddock took a moment to adjust to frankness. "We understand about your Asperger's, Patrick, and we certainly have made allowances for it. But I have formally to advise you that we cannot make endless allowances. If I have further reports of incidents of this nature, I will be forced to suspend your duties here at Cardiff. Do you understand?"
Patrick pursed his lips.
"Do you understand?"
"Yes, I understand," said Patrick. "I'm trying to decide whether I care." Professor Maddock raised his eyebrows, the way Mick had.
What do you mean?
I might not care. I might have finished here. I don't know if there's any point in going on.
No point in going on? What does that mean?
The professor's hand twitched again towards the cube. Patrick thought that Professor Maddock might have a touch of Asperger's himself, because he didn't seem to comprehend anything he was saying.
I think the cause of death on the sheet is wrong. What's the point of going on if I'm basing judgments on bad information?
Cause of death is certified by a doctor.
Doctors get it wrong all the time. You see it on TV.
Professor Maddock's hand flinched, and this time he followed through with a pickup and started to twist the cube's little colored blocks, frowning at them disapprovingly as he went on.
The DR technician told me you asked him about a doorway in the brain. Does that have anything to do with all of this?
Yes, said Patrick, and stared at the cube turning in the man's long, elegant fingers. I want to know what happens.
The professor sighed deeply and put down the cube.
You know, Patrick, all we see in the dissecting room is the physical aftermath of a life. A medical student starts his journey with the dead and works backwards.
Patrick pursed his lips. But I want to start with the dead and work forwards.
Professor Maddock gave a small laugh.
The dead can't speak to us, Patrick, although our lives would be immeasurably simpler if they could. While doctors might discover the mechanics of how someone died, they are privy to neither why they died nor to what happens to them after they die. To solve those puzzles, I think you'd need to consult a detective and a priest.
He smiled, but Patrick didn't. And how do they solve those puzzles? Said Patrick, leaning forward.
Professor Maddock looked a little taken aback by the sudden interest in a throwaway remark. He spread his hands in new uncertainty.
Well, I imagine a priest doesn't actually know. That's a matter of faith.
Superstition, Patrick corrected him. How does the detective know?
The professor gave it serious thought.
Well, he finally said, I suppose that to find out why somebody died, a detective would have to consult the living.
What kind of living?
Friends and family, witnesses, attending medical professionals, people like that, I suppose.
Patrick sat back in his chair, and Professor Maddock blew out his cheeks in relief. He wasn't sure how this conversation had turned from him issuing a formal warning to a student firing awkward philosophical questions at him. He needed to get back on track.
You know, Patrick, Dr. Spicer tells me that despite these difficulties, you're a real talent in the dissection room. He says you're a leading candidate for the Goldman Prize. It would be a shame to give up now, wouldn't it?
Patrick remained still for an uncomfortably long time. Finally, he nodded silently and rose to his feet, then paused and reached across the desk. The professor withdrew slightly, but Patrick picked up the Rubik's Cube. Professor Maddock watched as the matching colors spread quickly up the six sides until the puzzle was complete and Patrick laid it back on the desk.
It's not difficult, he said. I can show you if you like.
Thank you, said Professor Maddock.
And Patrick left. Chapter 25. The orange juice has gone to my chest. Pneumonia. They don't say it, but I know that's the fear. People die of pneumonia, even healthy people. But I'm incredibly vulnerable. Phlegm rattles in my throat and my back is agony every time I breathe. So I try not to do that. It doesn't work. Jean and Angie use the vacuum on me almost constantly. It's disgusting and painful. Two doctors come. I wonder if one of them is the killer. Who knows? I would if only I'd kept my eyes open that night. Would it be better or worse to know whether a killer was standing over me, taking my pulse, checking my drip? Right now, I don't care if one of them killed the man in the next bed, as long as they help me.
Blink twice if it hurts,
says one, tapping my chest in that creepy way that doctors do, as if they're trying to find a secret passage in a smuggler's wall. I blink lots, and they exchange worried looks. Without warning, tears roll out of my eyes and into my ears. I'm going to die.
and I will never have seen Alice or Lexi again. I'll never have told them how much I love them, or why I never came home that day, or where I've been since. I say. Don't try to talk, says the younger doctor. It will only hurt. He's right, but I don't care. I don't want to slip into unconsciousness and die without doing my best to leave something behind, even if it's a single word. I say. Duh. Shh, says Jean, holding my hand and looking nervous. I reckon she and Tracy will get it in the neck if I die. Leslie will be furious, in a monosyllabic sort of way. All that work wasted. Even now my tongue curls away from where I want it to be, and I have to think of everything he taught me. I make an enormous effort full of grunts and phlegm. What's that? Says the older doctor, then turns to Jean. Do you know what he's saying? I'll get the possum, she says, but I don't want it. I want to hear my own voice. I say as my lungs protest, my back spikes and sweat and tears pour down my nose and cheeks. I can't do the S. There, I did it. Angie, says Jean. Not Angie, for Christ's sake, Lexi. But it's all I can do, and it really doesn't matter whether they understand or not. If it's just the first word of thousands or the last one ever to pass my lips, at least I've named the most important thing in my life. Well done, says Jean, looking as relieved as she does encouraging. I'll get Angie to come and say hello. You'll be ordering us all about by lunchtime. Another big lie. Who cares? I don't even know what's true anymore. If you can't trust a mirror, what can you believe? Jean bustles away with the older doctor. The younger doctor takes my notes off the end of my bed. I can't see it happen. I just see the top of his head, but I know the feeling and the sound like my own breathing. The gritty little metal noise, and the tiny vibration it makes in the steel frame and through the mattress. The princess had her pee. I have my notes. He moves slightly so that I can see him as he reads them intently. I wonder what's written there. Just the injuries from the flying Ford Focus, or everything from childhood measles onwards. He reads them like they're instructions for a bomb disposal. Then he comes over, jabs a needle into my hip, and I close my eyes, exhausted by the effort and the pain of living. If I wake up dead, so be it. Chapter 26. There were only two Galens in the Cardiff phone book, and only one with the initial S. The house was up Penolan Road, a large red brick home set towards the back of a broad, unimaginative garden, where the only flowers were snowdrops and primroses in a narrow stripe either side of the wide gravel driveway. Everything else was shrubbery made of laurels and conifers. Patrick was allergic to conifers, and regarded them all with suspicion. If he lived here, he'd dig them all out and have a bonfire. He wheeled his bike past a late-registration BMW. This was how number 19 had lived. Well, it was a start. But to find out how he had died, Patrick guessed he needed more than he could gather from noting what kind of car the man had driven. He wasn't sure what he needed or how he was going to get it. But Patrick also knew that there were too many variables for him to have formulated a watertight plan of action. The front door might be opened by anyone, a wife, a mother, a son, a cleaner, and each of them would require a different strategy. But he only had one strategy. Therefore, the only concrete opening he had prepared was, "My name is Patrick Fort, and I want some information about Mr. Samuel Galen." He assumed everything would fall into place from there. Patrick put down the kickstand on his bike and knocked on the door. He could see his silhouette in the glossy black paint and his face in the chrome letterbox. "Go away! I've called the police!" Patrick blinked in surprise. It was a woman's voice, high and screechy, and illogical. Why would she have called the police before he'd even knocked? She didn't know why he was there. Even so, he was wary. He took a step backwards. Maybe he'd done something wrong, something he couldn't understand. It happened all the time,
Once, when he was 14, he'd almost been arrested for walking out of Asda wearing jeans and a blue striped T-shirt, so his mother, who was in the car, could approve the purchase. Patrick had tried to explain to the security guard that he had left his own clothes in the fitting room, so how could he be stealing these ones, especially with the label still swinging off them? Maybe this was like that, somebody not understanding things. The faint sound of breaking glass drew him and his bike around the side of the house to the back garden. He flinched, as glass broke much closer to him this time. A girl stood in the garden, a girl or a woman. Patrick was never quite sure when one became the other. She was as slim as a girl, but as angry as a woman. She had startling white blonde spikes of hair, and despite the late winter chill, wore a white T-shirt, black leather miniskirt, and motorcycle boots. She drew back her arm and hurled what looked like half a brick through a downstairs window.
"I've called the police!"
"So have I,"
the girl woman screamed back at the house.
"You fucking old cow!"
She turned away, and Patrick thought she was going to run, but instead she started to look around for something else to throw. It wasn't easy. The garden was as well tended as the house, apart from the broken windows. Even the soil in the shrubbery looked stone-free. Patrick couldn't see where she'd got the half-brick from.
"Hi," said Patrick.
The girl woman looked at him for the first time.
"Who are you?"
"Patrick Fort," said Patrick.
"Are you Mrs. Galen?"
"No, I'm fucking not," she spat vehemently, "and neither is she."
She parted the shrubbery. Patrick noticed a smallish stone next to his foot.
"Here,"
he said and held it out to her. The girl looked at him suspiciously, then came over and snatched it from his hand like a wary monkey.
"Cheers,"
she said, and threw it through an upstairs window. It made a neat black hole and a web of white cracks.
"The police are coming," he pointed out,
and she cocked her head at the sound of approaching sirens.
"Bollocks. I thought you called them."
"Yeah, right," she snorted, and walked over to the 6-foot wooden fence that surrounded the garden.
"You gonna give me a leg up, or what?"
Patrick wheeled his bike across the lawn and edged his way through the shrubs. He hesitated, then went to put his hands around her waist so he could lift her up.
"Watch where you're putting your hands, mate,"
she said, and he took a step backwards.
"Like this?"
She made a stirrup with her fingers. He flinched as she stepped into his interlaced fingers, and then almost slung her clean over the fence. She was so light, and he was so keen to be rid of her. He wiped his hands hard on the seat of his jeans.
"You coming?"
she said from the other side. Was he? Patrick stood for a moment weighing up his options and objectives. He wanted information. The woman in the house probably wouldn't speak to him, whereas the girl in the garden had. She was probably his best bet.
"Okay," he said.
He'd never escaped over a fence before and wasn't quite sure of the procedure. He propped his bike against it, then stepped on the crossbar and lay precariously along the fence, with the planking digging a long line of discomfort from his shoulder to his balls, while he gripped with one hand and his feet. He teetered there and stretched an arm back down to grip the crossbar. He should have put the bike over the fence first.
"Come on! I'm getting my bike," he explained. "There's no time!"
Two uniformed policemen walked briskly round the side of the house, and Patrick realized too late that he'd chosen the wrong team. They saw him and started to jog across the lawn.
"Oi!" shouted one. "Stay right there!"
A rush of adrenaline took Patrick completely by surprise. It fired a stream of white-hot excitement through his body. No video game had ever made him feel this way, and he laughed at the policemen as they speeded up across the grass. But the bike anchored him on the wrong side of the fence. He should really leave it. He didn't. He hauled it up one-handed, his shoulder burning with effort and his chest and balls shrieking to be allowed off the narrow wooden ridge. He would have overbalanced back into the garden, except that the girl who wasn't Mrs. Galen grabbed two handfuls of him, his jeans and his hoodie, and provided a counterweight as he lifted his bike up to join him, until his weight shifted and they both rolled off the fence and dropped onto the ground, only missing the girl, because she jumped out of the way with a shriek. He lay in the alleyway, winded and staring at the same sky that had been there the day of the monkey bars and the swing. The first of the policemen hit the other side of the wooden fence with a grunt. The girl yelled, "Run! Run!" then took her own advice and disappeared from his field of vision. Patrick was on his feet in an instant, running alongside his bike, until he had the presence of mind to jump into the saddle like a Dodge City bank robber onto a getaway pony.
He heard the police shouting something behind him, but never looked back, and very soon his pedalling took him to a calmer, quieter place, as it so often had. He caught up with the girl in the park down at the bottom of the hill. She was walking now, not running, and staying close to the shadows of the rhododendrons. He slowed his bike beside her and said, "Hi." She put a hand to her chest.
"Shit, you nearly gave me a heart attack."
But she started laughing then, and didn't stop until she was crying.
"Shit," she said again, "that bitch."
She wiped her eyes, leaving dark streaks from her eyes to her temples. Patrick waited until she had finished.
"You want to get a drink?" she said.
"I don't drink," Patrick told her.
"Don't be stupid," she said.
They went into the Claude on Albany Road.
"You got any money?"
she said. So Patrick bought her a rum and coke, and himself a coke without the rum.
"You really don't drink?" said the girl. "Why?"
"No reason," he said.
"Liar."
He wondered how she had known, but said nothing else. They sat at a table near the door, and she clinked his glass with hers.
"Bottoms up," she said.
She drank half her rum and coke in one go.
"What was your name again?"
He was practiced at the answer now, and told her with barely a pause.
"Thanks for the leg up over the fence."
He nodded. "What's yours?"
"My what?" "Name,"
she said.
"Lexi,"
and drained her glass.
"Want another one?"
"I haven't finished this one." She hid a burp behind her fist, then reached over, took his coke from his hand, and swallowed it in three swift gulps.
"Want another one now?"
He bought her another one, and a coffee for himself, because he thought it would be cheaper, but it wasn't.
"You're not Samuel Galen's wife?" Patrick said, as he sat down with the drinks.
She took a gulp and shook her head.
"He was my dad."
"But she's not his wife, either?"
"She's just a fucking gold digger," she said. "You got a fag?"
"No." Lexi took out a pouch of tobacco and rolled her own.
"Sitting there in a bloody mansion with bloody great beamers out the front, while I'm kipping on a mate's couch above a fucking pet shop. Got a light?"
"No." Lexi went to the bar to ask for one, and the barman told her there was no smoking in the pub.
"Jesus Christ," she said,
and yanked the roll up from her lips and stormed back to her seat.
"Bastard says there's no smoking in a fucking pub."
"It's the law," Patrick pointed out.
"I know it's the law. Because of passive smoking. Thank you, Chancellor of the Exchequer."
"I'm not the Chancellor of the Exchequer."
"You don't say."
Patrick was confused, because he plainly had said.
"Stupid fucking rules,"
she said, and poked the roll up into her cleavage.
"What's wrong with your hand?"
Patrick looked at his knuckles, which were red, with long yellow blisters already coming. The shrubbery.
"Conifers," he said.
"I'm allergic."
"Allergies fucking blow," said Lexi enthusiastically. "I have a million of them. Fish, cats, eggs, you name it. Not trees, though. Does it hurt?"
"It itches." Patrick was finding it hard to keep up with Lexi's flood of words and emotions and expletives. She seemed to say anything and everything that popped into her mind. All Patrick had to do was try to sift the gold from the grit, but he wasn't sure which was which, and so let her stream of consciousness wash over him in the hope that he could sort it out later.
"What was going on at the house?"
"Oh, that," she said with a scowl.
"All I did was ask for my own money, and she goes bonkers."
"What money?"
"That my dad left me in his will. I need it now, not when I'm 25.
"No need to swear," said Patrick.
"Of course there's a need to swear," she said, slapping the table and making him flinch. "Swearing's the only thing that keeps me going. What kind of world do you live in where there's no need to fucking swear? A world where you don't drink and don't smoke and nothing ever pisses you off? I bet there's no sex either. Fan-fucking-tastic."
Patrick felt his face growing hot, and he stared into his coffee cup. He had never thought much about sex, but all of a sudden, not having had it seemed like a very stupid oversight for someone of his intellect. There was a long gap in the conversation, while the scratchy pub speakers played Wonderwall by Oasis. 1995, thought Patrick, before everything went wrong. He finished his coffee.
"I'm sorry," Lexi said. "I'm such a fucking big mouth. I just get so... you know? And then I say all kinds of stupid shit.
Okay, he nodded.
Seriously, said Lexi, ducking her head to try to meet his eyes. I'm an idiot.
She reached for his hand across the table. He saw it coming and fought his instincts.
What had his mother said? I don't expect anything back from you, Patrick, but I do expect manners.
That meant she did expect something back. She had given him a gift, and Patrick was apparently supposed to say thank you. Gifts came with strings attached, even if they weren't always obvious. Lex's father had allowed 5 strangers to cut him to pieces and put him into yellow bins and plastic bags. The string attached to that gift was right here, right now, coming at him across the scar and varnish pub table. He couldn't do it. He moved his hand and sat on it.
How did your father die?
Lexi picked up her glass instead. She didn't seem surprised by the question.
He was in an accident, and then a coma for a few months, and then he just died. They said he might. They said it happens all the time.
Who said?
I don't know. The doctors, I suppose.
Were you there? She shook her head and knocked back what was left of her drink, even though it was mostly ice now.
I only went to see him once. It was shit. He was crying. I held his hand, but he didn't even know it was me.
Patrick nodded.
Altered states, he said. You know, there have been cases where people woke from comas with previously unknown skills, thinking they're Abraham Lincoln or with an Italian accent, things like that.
He'd always found those accounts fascinating, but Lexi stared across the pub as if he hadn't spoken.
I don't care, she declared. It was an arse anyway. Arse isn't swearing, is it? I mean, it's what he was.
Okay, he said, then remembered about working backwards and added,
why? Was he an ass?
Lexi gave an exaggerated shrug and toyed with her glass. Patrick noticed that the dorsal metacarpal arteries showed sky blue up the backs of her pale hands. He wondered whether she and her father would be identifiable as relatives if they were laid out side by side and peeled of skin. He knew that he himself had a strange twist to his thumbs that his mother had given him, and that when he shaved he could see his father's mouth and eyes in the bathroom mirror, like a ghost in the glass. How deep did such bonds go? Was it all about eyebrows and lips? Or were there veins and kidneys that had similar familial quirks?
He didn't give a shit about me, said Lexi. I fucking hated him.
Then, before Patrick could ask her why, she put her glass down firmly and said,
you got a couch?
Once she was on the couch, Lexi was impossible to dislodge. She watched Hollyoaks and EastEnders with Kim and Jackson, while Patrick went upstairs and cleaned another 3 squares of carpet. When he came down at 10 o'clock, she was still there, watching something full of guns and noise, with a remote control in her hand. Jackson and Kim cornered him in the kitchen.
She has to go, hissed Kim. Kim's right, hissed Jackson. She has to go.
Okay, said Patrick, and started to make a peanut butter sandwich while they both watched him.
Kim said, you brought her here. You have to tell her.
Okay, he said, and cleaned up after himself. Then he put the sandwich on a plate that had a cartoon zebra in the middle and the alphabet around the outside. It was a child's plate, but the alphabet had always calmed him, so he brought it with him from home, and Kim had dubbed it Retro Hip. He took it through to the living room, where Lexi had now spread herself down the length of the sofa.
You have to go, he informed her. What are you eating? She said. I'm quite hungry. Peanut butter sandwich. She made a face. Have you got some cheese?
Yes, he said. Kim and Jackson say you have to go.
Can I have a cheese sandwich?
He stood for a moment, uncertain of what to do next. He had told her she had to go, and she'd ignored that and asked for a cheese sandwich. He didn't understand how the two were connected, but he didn't mind giving her a cheese sandwich. Maybe she'd go after that. Things wouldn't happen in the expected order, but they'd happen.
Okay, he said, and went back to the kitchen. Has she gone? Said Jackson.
No, she wants a cheese sandwich.
Shit, said Kim. Jackson, tell her she has to go.
Jackson looked unsure, but left the kitchen. Patrick was considering whether to cut the sandwich square or on the diagonal when he came back.
"Has she gone?"
demanded Kim.
"She wants a blanket." "Oh, for fuck's sake, Jackson!"
Kim stormed out, and Patrick went for square because he always had his sandwiches cut square. So if Kim made Lexi leave now, he could take this one with him for lunch tomorrow.
"She just ignored me," said Jackson, biting his nails.
"Me too," said Patrick.
"Now Kim thinks I'm a wuss."
Patrick nodded his agreement.
"Shit,"
said Jackson softly. They listened to the low voices from the front room, and then heard footsteps ascending the stairs and coming down again. Then more low voices. Then Kim came back into the kitchen and didn't look at them. She opened the fridge and pushed things around her shelf for a long time.
"Is she gone?"
said Jackson.
"Did someone eat my yogurt?"
said Kim.
"No,"
said Jackson and Patrick together.
"Oh,"
said Kim and shut the fridge door and went upstairs. Jackson followed her. When Patrick took the sandwich through to the front room, Lexi was wrapped in a red blanket on the couch.
"Thanks,"
she said as she took a bite.
"Have you got anything to drink?"
He brought her a glass of water and she said,
"Have you got anything else?"
He knew what she meant. He also knew there was a half bottle of white wine on Kim's shelf in the fridge.
"No,"
he said.
"Not very good students, are you?"
"I'm the best in dissection. Jackson says Kim's good, but I don't know about art. It just looks lumpy to me." She fidgeted and ate half a sandwich while he watched, then asked where the toilet was. She was gone for 10 minutes and came back with the wine.
"I found this in the fridge. I'll replace it tomorrow."
He said nothing.
"You want some?"
He shook his head. Lexi poured her water into the puny rubber plant and filled the tumbler with wine instead. She drank it the way she had the rum and coke, in rapid, repeated drafts, as if she was impatient to see the bottom of the glass. Then she refilled it.
"You drink too much," said Patrick.
"You talk too much," she snapped back. They watched something about driving trucks on icy roads. Every time a truck skidded off, Lexi giggled and glanced at him. She checked the empty bottle twice. Patrick knew it wouldn't be the last time and couldn't bear to watch.
"I'm going to bed," he said. "Hey, Patrick," she said. "I know when I've had too much. I've been drinking since I was, like, 14 or something. So I think I know what I'm doing by now."
"Okay," he said.
"Everybody's so judgmental. Gets on my fucking tits."
"Okay."
"I'm sorry, didn't mean to swear. Sorry."
Sorry. The word meant nothing to him. It was like static, and he'd learned to ignore it.
"Thanks for the sandwich," she said. "See you in the morning."
"Okay," he said, and went upstairs. Around 1 a.m, he woke to find Lexi worming her way onto his narrow bed alongside him.
"That couch is made for midgets,"
she said, all elbows and bottom. She was still wrapped in the blanket and he was in his sleeping bag, but the thought of her body pressed along the entire length of his galvanized him. He stood up and stepped over her as if crossing an electric fence, and picked up his sleeping bag.
"Where are you going?" she said. "Downstairs. Don't bang your head on the bicycle."
"What?" she said, but he didn't answer her. The couch was made for midgets, so he settled down on the carpet on his side and with his knees tucked up just enough to avoid touching the water tank that wasn't there, and thought about Lexi. There was so much to think about. She was like a tornado that had picked him up, whirled him high and dumped him, dazed, in a foreign field. It was scary, but it was also exciting. It was hard to separate her from the information she had given him. The gold digger in the big house, the half brick through the window, the frozen inheritance, the rum and coke. Those things told him lots about Lexi, but all they told him about Samuel Galen was that he was rich, mean, and dead. Patrick frowned into the darkness and felt the familiar itch of an unsolved puzzle. Maybe he should have stuck with the gold digger. Maybe she'd have been more coherent. Almost certainly she wouldn't have followed him home and demanded a couch, a blanket, and a cheese sandwich. Almost certainly he'd be asleep in his own bed now. Patrick sighed and blinked against the crook of his elbow pillow. His eyes grew used to the night until he was able to see a pale curve under the couch. He tried to work out what it was,
but finally had to touch it to discover the plate on which he'd brought Lexi the sandwich. She had left her crusts, even though he'd put the cheese right up to the edges. Patrick made a good sandwich. He liked them because their structure meant he could put almost anything in them that didn't start with A. Bread was always on the outside, then butter. Then, as long as the fillings continued from the outside to the inside in strict alphabetical order, the world was his oyster. Peanut butter was his favourite filling, but he had a soft spot for cheese and chutney, as much for their economy of alphabetical progression as for the taste. He wondered, floatily, whether Lexi would have eaten her crusts if it put chutney on her sandwich. But she hadn't asked for chutney, and had made a face at peanut butter, and he'd been too flustered to offer her Marmite, or... Patrick rolled onto his back, his breath suddenly shallow and his stomach fluttering with tension. He held his twisted thumbs up to the dark ceiling and thought again of the delicate blue veins in the backs of Lexi's hands. Her skin was so fine and pale. Nothing like number 19's tough, orange dermis. Making an H incision in her throat would be completely different. There would be no scrape of old stubble against his knuckles. No Adam's apple to teeter up and down again. No smell of lilies and shit. Only the pliable tracheal rings, dipping gently into the jugular notch at the base of her smooth neck. Nothing about it would be the same as the cadaver's, even if her veins and kidneys did give away the family connection. But what if... What if family was about more than a visual match? What if it was also about the speed at which her neurons fired, or the rate at which her glands excreted, or the way her blood responded to chemical changes? Patrick stood up and kicked himself free of his bag, his own blood squirting powerfully through his heart, and a light sheen of sweat making his skin prickle in the cold room. He went upstairs and turned on his bedroom light with a bright click. Lexi was asleep on her back, with her hands clenched loosely on the pillow beside her head, the way a baby sleeps. She stirred at the light but didn't open her eyes. Patrick put out a tentative hand, then withdrew it. "Are you awake?" he said clearly. Her forehead creased.
"What?"
"Are you awake?"
"No."
"You must be, or you couldn't say no.
What do you want?"
"Are you allergic to nuts?" She squinted one eye open, then shielded it from the light.
"What?"
"Are you allergic to peanuts?"
"Yes, if I have one, I could die."
"Was your father?"
"Yes."
"Okay," said Patrick. He opened his wardrobe and put on his T-shirt and hoodie. Lexi sat up, hair awry, and hugged her knees through the red blanket.
"Why? What's going on?"
He didn't tell her because he didn't hear her. He was overwhelmed by a looped image of his own blue finger dipping into Samuel Galen's puckered flesh, like doubting Thomas peering into the side of Christ, while a question buzzed through his being. If number 19 was being fed through a tube, what was he doing with a peanut that might kill him in his throat? Lexi watched him pull on his jeans, then flinched as he reached over her head and took his bike from the hooks on the wall.
"You're nuts," she said.
He hoisted the bike onto his shoulder and hurried down the stairs. She scrambled off the bed and hung over the banisters to call after him.
"And your room stinks of bleach."
Chapter 27. I wake with a start in the dark, and the shadow beside my bed flinches too. I gave us both a fright, and if I could laugh, I would. It's the doctor who gave me a perfect 10, come to tap my chest. He does that with warm fingers, then breathes on the stethoscope. It's the little things that show they care. You'd never know otherwise. He listens to my lungs, staring past me at my pillow to avoid embarrassingly close eye contact. I wonder drowsily what he hears in there, whether my lungs have passed their orange juice crisis. My breathing still hurts, but nothing like it did a week ago. I'm on the mend. He stares intently at the linen beside my ear. Then he straightens up and looks in the direction of the nurse's station. I turn my head with a little surge of athletic achievement and follow his gaze. There is nobody there.
It was going to happen.
Tracy Evans could feel it in the air. She was on 3 nights in a row. She got a spray tan, her eyebrows threaded, her legs waxed, and her pubic hair ripped agonizingly into a dark little heart. It didn't match her blonde hair, but nobody had ever complained. She was wearing underwear that matched and wasn't grey, and she'd bought that perfume by Brittany,
Not fat, bald Brittany, but slutty Brittany in school tie and knee socks. Now she wore her ugly blue tunic with new sensuality, her smooth new wonders sliding beneath its utilitarian starch. On the first night, Mr. Deal had sniffed the air around her, but hadn't gone for it immediately, which was slightly annoying, but at least it had given the pimples on her pubis time to calm down. This was the second night, and she had swapped shifts with Monica, who was new and easily bossed about, and even more easily deceived. Tracy had already been through the quality street and eaten all the big purple ones while Monica was helping someone with a bedpan. She heard the lift doors open and felt a delicious twitch as Mr. Deal came round the corner, silhouetted against the harsh fluorescence. Tracy hid Rose Budding, which she was rereading, then picked up a sheaf of random paperwork, pushed out her chest, sucked in her tummy, and composed her form and her features into their most flattering aspect. "Hello, Tracy," he said quietly, and she turned as if surprised and gave him the demure but promising smile she'd practiced so long in the mirror. Slutty nun, she called it. She was rewarded by seeing his brooding face soften into a look of being pleased to see her. Men were so easy. But he'd better make his move before she had to go through the hell of waxing again, or she'd make him suffer. For an hour, Mr. Deal stood with his back to his wife with a cup of machine coffee. At 9 p.m. he had another. Tracy knew that nobody chose to have two cups, so he was obviously killing time. She went into the ladies' bathroom and threw away the cardboard bedpans that she routinely left stinking on the windowsill. Made the place a bit nice. At 10:30 p.m. Mr. Deal put another pound into the coffee machine, and Tracy Evans's nipples responded. Just after 11, she told Monica to go out for a cigarette. As they were on the fourth floor, Tracy knew that that entailed a 15-minute round trip for a 2-minute smoke, and so Monica usually had a couple while she was outside the ambulance bay doors, which took it up to 20 minutes. Plenty of time, in her experience. "You sure?" said Monica. "Course," said Tracy. "You go, I'll be fine." The lift doors closed, and Tracy got up and hitched up her bra straps. The dance had been slow and frustrating, but she knew that the end of it would be as familiar to her as her own reflection. The doctor looks back down at me and clears his throat. "I'm very sorry, Mr. Galen," he says softly. My mind turns slowly around the pivot of his words. "He does sound very sorry. What for?" I start to worry. Maybe he heard something in my lungs. Maybe I'm not as on the mend as I thought I was. Maybe... Then he leans over me again, and I see that in his right hand he holds a pair of tweezers, and that between their glittering points is a peanut. My heart spasms with electric terror, and in an instant I understand everything. He's the one. He's the killer. And he knows how incredibly vulnerable I am. My panicked hand flaps like a fish on a bedspread beach as my memory detonates. I'm 4 years old, and my throat tightens and my eyes swell shut, even while the traitorous treat still seasons the inside of my mouth. My mother screams somewhere, and my head bounces on my father's arm as he runs from the stalled car into the hospital, shouting, "He can't breathe! He can't breathe!" I'm jostled and tossed and snatched from my father's arms by other arms in white sleeves, and the lights jiggle overhead as the doctor runs down the corridor to save my life with a scalpel and a tube in my throat so that I can grow up to bring the stubby hands to the marital table. The stubby hands and the allergies listed on my medical notes for everyone to see. The doctor lowers the peanut towards my lips. "Gah!" I cry. "Gah!" I'm more scared now than when I was a child. No one is going to help me this time. I feel a knuckle against my chin, the nut nudging my lip, and I jab out my well-trained tongue, my only defense. It knocks the peanut from the grip of the tweezers, and for a split second I'm triumphant. And then I feel it drop instead into the back of my throat. Dying is far easier than it looks in the movies. There are no flashy cuts, no explosions, no speeches. Just a clumsy doctor swearing and fumbling between my teeth, digging the sharp tweezers into my palate and tongue, even as my throat swells jealously around the evidence he wants back. The terror, the panic, the sorrow for all I'm leaving behind. I can't die. I have people to hold, to love, to make it up to. Too late.
too late. Pain cleaves me. My jaw clamps in agony and I slither back down the well. There's no tunnel, no light, no return. Darkness snaps shut and truth spills from my dead heart. I love you, I love you, I love you. A small hand takes mine.
Look at it go, Daddy.
Chapter 28 4017 The ugly code had its uses. Patrick took a while to find the switches, then blinked as the light shuddered awake to banish shadows from the dissecting room. The cadavers were just sickly sweet leftovers now. Missing limbs, gaping chests, with their skin peeled off them in dirty brown folds, and their pale brains gleaming with wetting solution beside their empty skulls. Yet they seemed more alive to Patrick now than they had at the start, more real now that he understood them better. As he passed them, his sense of excitement grew. He knew the cause of death. He was sure of it. The list was wrong. Mick was wrong. Spicer was wrong. His fellow students were wrong. And whatever doctor had signed the death certificate was wrong. None of them knew what he knew, that Lexi Galen had an allergy to peanuts. And Patrick would bet the bicycle he'd inherited from his father that she had inherited that allergy from hers. He couldn't wait to tell them all that it solved the puzzle, especially Scott. Patrick looked down at number 19, whose one remaining eye stared through him dully. He looked away quickly and hunched down beside the table. Underneath it were the scores of bags that slowly filled with the dead man's lungs, his liver, his small intestines, all pressed against the clear plastic like the cheap mince his mother bought from the wagon at Brecon Market. More of number 19 was now under the table than on it. Patrick sorted through it all, but couldn't find the peanut. He frowned. That made no sense. He had bagged it and tagged it himself. He was too impatient. It was small. He must have missed it. He went through the process again in slow reverse, sitting on the cold floor, loading the shelf under the table more carefully this time. The peanut was not there. Patrick sat very still. One of the others had got there first. Scott? Dilip? But how? How had they known about the allergy when he'd only found out by accident? Had he missed something obvious? And if they didn't know about the allergy, why would they take it? The lights went out, and he was blind. He quickly squeezed his eyes tightly shut. It was a trick his father had taught him on night walks in the beacons. Too late he registered that the main door of the biosciences block had been open. He'd not noticed it because he'd never seen it closed, but in the middle of the night it would have been, should have been, unless someone was already inside. Idiot! He opened his better-adjusted eyes. A black figure was framed in the charcoal doorway. Patrick started to get up to leave, but before he could, the man entered the room. Strangeness rippled up the back of Patrick's neck. Turning off the lights before entering a room made no sense. So instead of standing up and asking why the lights were off, Patrick stayed put on one knee and one spread hand, his stomach knotting with a fear that was all the more fearful because he didn't understand it. The man walked confidently between the bodies, as if he did so in the dark all the time. There was no fumbling, no banged shins or muttered expletives. Between the struts of the tables and the remains of the ruined bodies, the figure walked swiftly towards him, announced only by the small squeak of shoes on polished linoleum. He was coming straight for him. Without thinking, Patrick crawled silently onto the shelf below table 19, along with the bags of meat and bone and offal. Lex's cold father gave a little under his body, and he almost cried out with the idea of the cold flesh cushioning him. Only the plastic between them stopped him screaming. He bit his own lip as the shadow stopped beside him. In a moment that rushed him back to the bookies and the Labrador, Patrick watched the knees and the thighs of the man's black trousers turn slowly, as if scanning the room, looking for something. Patrick stopped breathing. If he could have stopped his heart pounding, he would have. The moment seemed endless. Then the legs walked away and back towards the door. For a second, Patrick was relieved. Then he realized that if the man left the block, the outer door would be locked, trapping him inside. He rolled off the bags of cold meat and one of his trainers squealed on the floor. He froze again, then quickly pulled the shoes off his feet and slid swiftly across the floor on his socks to table 21 and from there to table 13. The man was still ahead of him. He had to catch him up or slow him down. Patrick wasn't a spy. He didn't have a grappling hook or satellite communications, or even a black turtleneck sweater. He had his trainers, that was all. So he hurled one of them into a dim corner of the room, where it landed with a slap and a clatter. He almost laughed when the man stopped, turned, and then followed the noise to the back wall like a stupid dog, while Patrick skidded out of the door in his socks. He couldn't ride properly with one trainer, so he walked, half-ran, pushing his bike and with his socks wet and stretching and tripping him up, until finally he peeled them off and dropped them in the gutter. His foot was shockingly white under the street lights. A police car passed, and Patrick pressed himself into a garden hedge, even though he'd done nothing wrong. Something told him that this was one of those occasions when people might not understand what he'd been doing, and he had no answers tonight, only questions that made his head ache to think of them. Before, Patrick had only thought about the peanut in relation to how Number 19 had died, not why. Why was a far tougher puzzle, and now that it was gone, the peanut seemed to be a critical piece of that jigsaw. How did Number 19 ingest a peanut that could kill him, and why would somebody steal it now? Cold rain trickled under his T-shirt and down his back, and still he stood there. For the first time that he could ever remember, and he could remember almost everything, Patrick knew he needed help. Patrick didn't have his blue gloves with him, but he stopped at the payphone outside the bookies and dialed with a wet sleeve pulled over his shivering index finger. It took 13 rings before the mechanical rhythm was halted by the sound of sleepy mouth breathing and a croak that might have been hello. If there was something that proved how someone had died, he said, why would you want to hide that? There was a long silence, and then his mother said shakily, who is this? Why is he asking? What's happened? Seraphort's head asked the questions her heart didn't want answered. She had been expecting the worst for years, ever since Patrick was a small boy. And yet time hadn't dulled the sharp panic she felt pricking her chest and starting to turn her stomach. What do you mean? She asked him. Anyone but Patrick would have noticed her voice shaking. Say someone dies, he said again, and then if someone else, not the dead person, someone else. He was obviously getting muddled, but she didn't help him out. She was in no hurry to hear what he wanted to say. She would wait all night, all her life, rather than help him to reach the point where everything she had done for both of them would fall apart. But he persisted. He was always so bloody persistent. If that someone hides something that might show why the other person died. Yes, she said faintly. Well, what does that mean? Sarah paused. I don't understand the question. She knew she was being obtuse. Things would be so much simpler if she'd just said, what are you trying to tell me, Patrick? She didn't ask because he would tell her, and she didn't want to deal with whatever might happen after that. She would rather play this precarious game of denial. Why are you calling tonight? It's not Thursday. I know, he said. I need help. Are you all right? She was surprised to hear a sharp note of concern in her voice, despite everything. I lost one of my trainers, and I need help to understand the actions. What actions? Hiding the thing, he said in a tone that revealed his frustration, that might show why something happened. What does that action mean? She thought carefully of the best way to answer him, and then did. People hide things because they don't want anyone to know about them. Why? You tell me, Patrick, rotting animals under your pillow and pictures of dead children and crazy lists of weird words. You tell me. Instead, she said, I suppose because they feel guilty. About what? Sarah felt sick. Doing something bad. Like what? I don't know, Patrick. Something bad. Something very, very bad. There was a pause. So, what must I do about it? What indeed? She felt emotion start to clog her throat. Do whatever you think best, she said hoarsely. Best for who? Sarah could barely whisper. For you! There was a long silence, And then Patrick said an abrupt, "Okay," in a tone she knew meant that for him, the conversation was over. She didn't press him, even though it was 3 in the morning and any other mother would have done, should have done, any mother of a different son. But she was only relieved that he'd stopped asking questions that made her fear him, even as she feared for him. "Good," she said, and then, "Goodbye." She sat in the kitchen with the phone in her lap, long after Patrick had rung off. It was a harsh February, and the kitchen fire had long since gone out. But she shivered for other reasons, too. The cold from the stone floor seeped through her socks and crept achingly up her ankles and her shins. And still she sat there, thinking about her strange son calling her on a strange night to ask a strange question. The splinter of progress she thought she'd seen at Christmas, away from the obsessive past and into a more normal future, now seemed like a cruel deception. She wasn't a religious woman, but she wanted a sign, a single, solid indicator that Matt's life, and hers, had not been wasted. She couldn't think of one, not one. On another night, a warmer night, or if the fire had not gone out, or if the cat had been sitting on her lap, habit alone might have been enough to keep her going. But this night was cold, and this night was dark, and the cat was outside killing small things. So there was nothing to stop her standing up and staring out of the kitchen window at the fiesta outside the old wooden shed. Nothing to stop